This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We talk a lot about heroes in today's culture. In fact, the word has lost a little bit of its luster. But the world lost a hero a few weeks ago, or at least someone who did a pretty heroic thing, and it's someone whose name you may not know. Let's just say if you woke up this morning and you didn't have smallpox, thank Dr. D.A. Henderson.
And around the world, this has been a disease which has killed hundreds of millions of people. It's been the most feared disease of all time.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll dip into the archives and replay my interview with Dr. Henderson, who passed away last month at the age of 87. We'll also hear commentary from the head of the New York Teachers Union about ways to solve the ongoing teacher shortage. And we'll spend an academic minute opening up a window to your brain. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If there was ever a worldwide enemy of humanity, it was smallpox. Now, that sounds dramatic, but think about it. In the 20th century, 100 years after the development of a vaccine against the disease, it still killed over 300 million people worldwide. That's when the World Health Organization made an unprecedented decision: eradicate smallpox from the face of the earth. The man they put in charge of that effort was Dr. Donald Ainslie Henderson. D.A. Henderson died last month at the age of 87. He was honored many times in countries around the world for his accomplishments, including receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2002. I had a chance to talk to Dr. Henderson in 2009 about his book called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease, the inside story of eradicating a worldwide killer. I asked him what was it about smallpox that made that the disease to go after.
Well, smallpox has been throughout history the worst pestilential disease people can experience. And even in this country, as late as 1972, we were still vaccinating. All children had to be vaccinated before they went to school because of the fear that smallpox might be introduced and we have to keep up a level of protection. We hadn't had a case in 23 years in the United States when we finally stopped in 72. And around the world, this has been a disease which has killed hundreds of millions of people. It's been the most feared disease of all time.
Let's go back for a minute and just talk about smallpox. As a disease, what does that do to a person?
Well, it's caused by a virus, and the individual will inhale it, if you will, from a patient, droplets. He'll feel perfectly well for 10 or 12 days, then he'll develop a terribly high fever, absolutely miserable, aching all over, go to bed. And then a little rash begins to appear. It's on the face and then the arms and the rest of the body. And these are little like pustules and little boils, little tiny boils. And they begin to expand. And a boil is very painful as it gets bigger. And these were just all over the body. They're in the mouth. They were over the tongue. So the individual had trouble eating. He had trouble drinking. And it would go on for a good 10, 12 days before the scabs would form and they'd fall off. But 3 out of 10 people died. There was no treatment for it at all. And a number of them were left blind as a result of this. So it was a horrible disease, which was feared in every country. And there were cultures that had deities, goddesses and gods of smallpox in China and Japan and India. And it's the only disease for which there are deities in different cultures. It was so greatly feared.
How contagious was it, or is it?
Yeah, it was moderately contagious. If you got a case in a household, that most of the other people in the household would come down with the disease. But the thing of it was that the individual didn't spread the disease until after he got this high fever and began to feel miserable. And so most of the people just went to bed. They felt so terrible. So they weren't out wandering around to spread it. And that made a big difference. If you have measles, for example, children can spread the measles even before they develop the rash. So they can be out and around and spread it even before they know they're ill. Well, with smallpox, that didn't happen. So it spread more slowly, but it just spread it was like a tank. It just kept rolling on and killing people. And if they survived, they were immune from having the disease ever after.
Well, by the time you came along with your eradication program, the vaccine had already been developed for some time. When was that vaccine developed?
The vaccine is our first vaccine. It was developed back in 1796. You can believe it. It was an English physician, a country physician by the name of Edward Jenner. And the lore at the time said that dairymaids got an infection called cowpox from cows, and they were protected from the smallpox, and indeed they were. So he took a little material from one of the pustules on the dairymaid's hand and then inoculated a little boy and later showed that he was protected against smallpox. So it was our world's first vaccine. And it's continued since then. Instead of taken directly from cows, actually for a long time we just grew it on the flank of a cow. So that was the protection that we had.
Well, you had a vaccine. You lived in a country where there hadn't been a case in a while. You were given this task. How did you begin?
Well, we had $2.4 million altogether. That was to cover the world. We couldn't even buy the vaccine we needed at that point. So we had to really start from scratch. We wanted to get all the countries behind the program. That was done in meetings and various messages we'd send out and a great deal of travel to persuade them to join in. But most of the countries were actually very fearful of smallpox. And if we could get vaccine for them, they would join in. And if we get a little money to buy a few vehicles, they would be able to do a lot more. And so little by little, we built a program. Unfortunately, this was an interesting time because we got a lot of help from the Russians, who provided 25 million doses of vaccine every year. And the Americans also gave vaccine and provided help. So it was during the worst days of the Cold War, I had the support of both the Soviet Union and the United States. And we got along very well, actually.
If anything showed how much this disease was feared, that did.
Indeed, it did. Travelers all over the world, to go from one country to another country, had to have a little booklet, and in that was marked that you had to be vaccinated within the previous 3 years, even to get admitted to the country. It was true in the United States. It was true in other countries. We were so afraid of somebody bringing the disease in. And this is the only disease for which everyone had to carry this little yellow card. So you can see that it was something tremendously feared. The first year we began, we were able to estimate that we had about 10 million cases and about 2 million deaths that year. It was a bad, bad problem.
Well, mass vaccinations, of course, was one of the things you had to organize. But you said surveillance was at least equally as important. Tell us what you meant by that.
Well, up until 1967, when the program began, people, when they felt they had a lot of cases of smallpox, they'd go out and governments would do a big program and vaccinate a lot of people, and they'd report how successful they'd been as they'd vaccinated so many people. But the idea of keeping track of where the cases were and when they occurred and what you did about it, that was just a new idea. So what we did was to try to get every health center and every hospital in each of the countries to report every week if they had cases of smallpox. And then when they reported them, we had the countries set up a team which would go out. And the team would go out where the case was, see if there were other cases, and then they'd vaccinate all around the cases, like a circle around where the cases are. Well, what this did was then provide the people who got vaccinated would be protected. And the individual had the smallpox couldn't spread to anybody. And the remarkable thing about smallpox is that man is the only mammal that can be infected. So we had no animals out there. And the only way the virus could survive would had to go from person to person to person. You could think of it as kind of like a chain. So this is what we had. It was surveillance, and then we had called it containment, firefighting teams that would go out, if you will, and to put out a little fire each time. And this had a tremendous effect. It was surprising how rapidly we could set up these reporting systems. They were just not used to reporting anything from health centers.
You said, of course, the U.S. and the Russians were cooperating. Did you have any resistance from any countries?
Well, we had some. There were some countries that didn't feel it was a big enough problem, and frankly, they didn't want to do anything about it. We had some of that in Ethiopia. We had troubles in some of the countries where we had fighting, and Somalia was very resistant to having things done. We just had to work at this little by little, and we used all sorts of devices. I guess approaching Ethiopia, we found somebody that knew the emperor pretty well, and we were stopped from doing a program there, but then we got to the emperor, and the emperor said, go set up a program. And so it took about 3 years of work before we finally persuaded him, but there we were.
Well, if you can get the emperor, you're pretty much in then.
Yeah, it really took care of things pretty quickly.
Yes.
And this is true, and you could get the head of state, it really made a big difference. And I know this happened likewise in India, where by various means we really got to Prime Minister Indira Gandhi.
Well, you mentioned Somalia, and the last reported case was in Somalia in 1977. How long after that did you feel comfortable that, yes, we've got it?
Well, we had made a decision that it probably we would need to do searching for cases to try and find chains of smallpox for at least 2 years before we could feel confident in any one area. And then during that time of 2 years, they really had to do a pretty good job of checking out cases and so forth. So it was set up to do in every country at least 2 years after the last case and to document this very carefully. At the end of that time, we sent in an international group commission to look and see, verify what they'd done, were they satisfied, and would they pronounce that they had eradicated the disease in that country. So the last case was October of 1977. We spent the next 2 years with a lot of teams and searching. The WHO then, we had put up a reward of $1,000 for anybody who found a case of smallpox. Interestingly, in a couple of countries, it brought in a lot of tourists. That is to say, they found tourists with acne or something, and they were brought in as possible cases of smallpox. But at the end of the time, we were able finally to say, we don't think there's any more smallpox. And then the World Health Assembly met in May 8, 1980, and declared that smallpox had been eradicated, and we can stop vaccination everywhere on Earth.
Well, there are no more cases of smallpox, but smallpox still does exist in a couple of laboratories across the world. One in the U.S., one in Russia?
That's correct. There are two.
Why do we still have that? Why don't we just, burn those last samples?
Well, this is a point of controversy at the moment. There are a number of people who feel we should destroy the last specimens that we have. But then there are some virologists who feel, well, we might learn something more because we still have the virus. And they've insisted that we should keep them and maybe we ought to develop a better vaccine than the one we have in case we need it. And maybe we ought to develop some drug, an antivirus drug that would prevent or be able to treat a case. And so there's been every year or every couple of years in the World Health Assembly, where all of the health ministers meet once in Geneva, there's usually a prolonged argument about destroying the virus. And the U.S. and Russia, Britain are the three principal ones who said, well, we should keep the stocks. And the developing countries, by and large, say, wait a minute, we don't want any thought that this might escape, but it's happened, and we just don't want to risk it. We know what the disease is like. So there's been an argument every year. There's going to be more this coming year, 2010, and hopefully they will reach a decision to destroy the virus in 2011. At least I hope so.
Well, this was, many people call this the greatest achievement in medicine. What achievements are left? Can we eradicate other diseases, tuberculosis, malaria, other diseases that are, not heard much in the United States, but are still big problems around the world?
Well, for a lot of technical reasons, I think it's going to be difficult to eradicate any of the diseases. That take tetanus and the spores are in the soil. You can't get rid of it that way. But we sure can do a lot with vaccines. And we can do a lot in preventing disease and controlling it. And since the smallpox program, what grew out of it was the polio eradication program. And polio is now restricted to just four countries. And there's just about 1,500 cases last year. So it's down from hundreds of thousands of polio cases. In the Americas, we've had no polio in the Western Hemisphere since about 1991, and after that, a number of the countries decided, let's eradicate measles. There are cases now that do come up, but that's because they're introduced from countries in Europe or Japan or wherever else the measles may be. And little by little, the measles is coming under tremendous control. And then that's a big advantage because this is a serious disease in the developing world. About 5% of the children die from it. It isn't like smallpox with 30%, but it's a very important bit. And there's a lot of work now going into research and vaccines for tuberculosis and for AIDS and for malaria. And if we could do something with those three with a vaccine, it would be a real miracle.
Dr. D.A. Henderson passed away on August 19th at the age of 87. At the time of his death, he served as the editor emeritus of the academic journal Health Security. We spoke in 2009 about his book, Smallpox, The Death of a Disease, the inside story of eradicating a worldwide killer. And one note here, those final batches of smallpox, they still exist in laboratories in the United States and in Russia. Still to come, we'll get commentary on what to do about the shortage of qualified teachers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, any place. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Finding and keeping qualified teachers is a problem across the U.S. Karen McGee, the president of the New York State United Teachers Union, has some ideas on how to solve that problem.
There's been a lot of hand-wringing lately about New York's teacher shortage. In many places, school districts are having difficulty filling open positions. And the problem is likely to get much worse. About one-third of New York teachers are approaching or already past their anticipated retirement age. The teacher shortage is most acute for districts needing teachers in subjects like physics, chemistry, and math, as well as the foreign languages and special education. Small rural districts and large urban districts seem to be having the most difficult time attracting and retaining qualified teachers. The shortage extends to substitute teachers as well. As the economy improves, many school districts report they are finding it more difficult to attract qualified subs. Ask teachers anywhere if they're surprised by this news, and I promise you, you'll hear a chorus of all-knowing laughter. What did policymakers expect would happen if, over a prolonged period of time, they attacked teachers and denigrated the profession? What did they expect when people who know little or nothing about teaching and how public education works slash budgets and pass laws mandating incessant testing, not teaching and learning? Why is anyone surprised that fewer young people are choosing teaching as a career? In fact, over the last 5 years, the number of students entering teacher education programs in New York has declined by 46%. In recent months, the State Education Department, Regents, and the SUNY Chancellor have all recommended steps to help districts attract and retain teachers. They've even gone so far as hastening the licensing process for teachers who come here from other states. They've also made it easier for districts to keep long-term substitutes. Most of this is, frankly, little more than a Band-Aid. Some so-called solutions make things worse. SUNY's Teach New York report demonstrated a disturbing disconnect between those in the ivory tower and those professionals doing the real work training New York's future educators. As a teacher myself and president of the union representing New York's teachers, the solutions to the teacher shortage are surprisingly simple. It starts with respect. Teaching is an exalted profession. Legislators and policymakers should revere and honor teachers, lifting the profession and making it more attractive to young people. Teachers must have a more prominent role in setting policy. Legislators and policymakers would never tell a surgeon how to operate or a Wall Street banker how to invest. But these folks aren't shy about telling teachers what and how to teach. That's got to change. Teachers must be given a real voice in the direction of their profession. Teachers' salaries must improve. While pay in some parts of the state is fair, in many places, teachers earn far less than other professionals with master's degrees and the same experience. It's difficult to entice a young person saddled with student loan debt to become a chemistry teacher when they can earn tens of thousands of dollars more as a chemist for a large corporation. School districts need support, too. The state can help districts by investing more in mentoring programs and in professional development. Here's a little secret. Roughly one-third of teachers who enter the profession leave within about 5 years. New York can reverse this trend by providing real support, professional development, and mentoring. If young teachers feel supported, get the professional training they need, have a voice in what happens in their classrooms, and can earn a decent living, the teacher shortage can be turned around. It's to everyone's benefit, especially our students, for New York State to do these things to attract the best people into the teaching profession and keep them there.
Karen McGee is a longtime elementary school teacher and the president of the New York State United Teachers. They say the eyes are the window to the soul. Well, that's all well and good, but how about a window to your brain? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Scientists are developing an actual window to the brain. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Guillermo Aguilar, professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of California, Riverside, discusses transparent skull implants and how they can give scientists a chance to deliver better treatments to their patients.
Laser-based treatments have shown promise for many brain disorders. However, since most medical lasers are unable to penetrate the skull, realization of this promise has been restricted by the need to remove a portion of the skull to access the brain each time a treatment is needed. For the past 5 years, my colleagues and I have been developing a transparent skull implant that literally provides a window to the brain. The technology will allow doctors to deliver multiple laser-based treatments to patients with life-threatening neurological disorders, including cancers, traumatic brain injuries, Alzheimer's disease, and stroke. The project began when we developed a transparent version of the material yttria stabilized zirconia, or YSZ, which is the same ceramic product used in hip implants and dental crowns. The inherent toughness of this material, which is more impact-resistant than glass-based materials under development by other researchers, make it the only transparent skull implant that could conceivably be used in humans. Our most recent studies have shown that YSZ is biocompatible, which means that it can be integrated into a patient's tissue without eliciting an immune response. In fact, it is as or more biocompatible than the non-transparent titanium or thermoplastic polymers that are currently used when patients require skull implants. We also showed recently that using laser therapy, the transparency of the implant could be exploited to mitigate bacterial infections, which are common after cranial implants. These infections are especially challenging to treat because many antibiotics do not penetrate the blood-brain barrier. Our long-term goal is to see the technology become the standard of care for patients with brain disorders who would benefit from laser-based treatments.
That was Guillermo Aguilar of the University of California, Riverside. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.